This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
I am honored to welcome back to this studio the one, the only, Ed Murphy, an astronomer from the University of Virginia. There you go. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
I'm very good. It's good to see you. I've been looking forward to it. So we had a celestial event last night in Africa.
That's right. Northern Sudan, a large body. Well, large compared to you and me, but in fact, in terms of astronomy, it was really quite small. A large asteroid entered the Earth's atmosphere. It was about 3 meters or 10 feet across. But
And it was in the Sudan, so
exactly.
It was in the desert?
It was in the remote areas.
Yeah.
So in fact, no one that we know yet has seen it fall. There may be people there who saw it fall, but there are no photographs of the fall yet, although there is a picture from a satellite looking down of the explosion.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, and when we mean explosion, what we mean is these things hit the atmosphere, and the deceleration from hitting the atmosphere slows it down so that they fragment, and they end up in a big burst of light. So it's an explosion, but not on the ground, high up in the atmosphere.
So the atmosphere is almost like this invisible shield, and these rocks hit it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And they blow up.
Exactly. They generally don't make it down to the ground, or what does make it down to the ground is fragmented and much smaller.
So where did it come from?
Well, it was in orbit around the sun, but what was historic about this one is it's the first time in history that we've actually detected it before they hit. Things like this hit 5 to 10 times per year, but we usually don't know it until we see them burning up in the atmosphere. But this one was actually discovered a little more than a day earlier on Monday by an observatory at the University of Arizona. And they're doing an all-sky search looking for things that may hit the Earth, and not with the intention that there's much we can do, because there's really not much we can do.
Yeah.
but with the intention of mapping their orbits so that we can figure out if they might pose a danger in a few years or 10 years or 20 years from now. And they discovered this one and saw it was headed right for us. But there were no alarms set off because they knew from the beginning it was very small.
Yeah, yeah. And we have talked about this before, but can you quickly recap for folks who may have missed that interview the actual threat of there being some big meteor that hits the Earth and causes, the destruction of the Earth or
right. The
eradication of the human species and life on Earth?
There are two things we have to worry about, comets and asteroids. Asteroids are orbiting around the inner solar system. We can track their orbits quite well. And for the big things, what I would call the dinosaur killer kinds of asteroids that are 10 kilometers across, which is 6 miles across or bigger, we know where all of those are in the inner solar system.
And we're tracking those.
And we're tracking those. And none of them pose a threat right now or for the foreseeable future. The problem is comets. Comets come from way out in the solar system where we can't track them. And they just literally come rocketing into the inner solar system. And we have no way to know. We might discover it 6 months before closest approach. But we have no way of predicting 20 or 30 years what might show up in terms of comets.
And are there, we're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. And by the way, folks, you can join this conversation at any time, 977-1070. There's people whose job it is get up, go to work, and look out for comets, right?
That's right.
I mean, I would hope.
Yeah. Well, actually, not comets so much. Comets we leave up to amateur astronomers because the sky is huge and it's too difficult to really survey the whole sky every night. So for comets, we leave it up to amateur astronomers who literally go out with binoculars and scan the sky back and forth looking for a faint, fuzzy object that's not supposed to be there, that's not in any of the star catalogs. And then they will report that to professional astronomers who will then get on it and track it to see if it's really a comet. In return, they get the comet named after them.
Right, right.
But that's all we have out there looking for comets specifically.
We're talking with Ed Murphy. And, of course, that brings us to the subject of telescopes. And the one of those best-known telescopes is the Hubble Space Telescope.
That's
which
right.
I guess, remind us again the whole idea. You can have really good telescopes on Earth, but putting one up in orbit in space gets you past all the dust and muck and you get a better view, right?
That's right. It gets you above mostly the blurring effect of the Earth's atmosphere. The reason the stars twinkle at night has nothing to do with the stars. It has to do with the Earth's atmosphere. As that light from the star passes through our atmosphere, pockets of air that have different temperatures bend that light back and forth. And as that light bends back and forth, it blurs the image of the star. So when we look with telescopes at objects in space from the surface of the Earth, the images all look blurry because of the Earth's atmosphere. We'd love to get outside of the Earth's atmosphere, and that was the primary point of the Hubble Space Telescope.
So stars from the Hubble Space Telescope don't twinkle, then?
They don't twinkle, that's right. They're rock steady, and they're not blurry because they're not passing through the Earth's atmosphere.
So what's the latest on the, first, when did it go up, and what was the problem? And you know,
it was launched in April of 1990, and shortly after launch, they couldn't bring it to a focus, and it was discovered that the primary mirror inside, the giant mirror inside of Hubble, which I should mention is not the biggest mirror that was ever made. There are ground-based telescopes that are much, much larger. It's just the biggest telescope that was ever launched into space. Found out it was ground incorrectly. The wrong curvature was put on it so that light couldn't be brought to a perfect focus.
And they fixed that, I guess.
Yeah. Well, they couldn't fix the mirror itself because it's an integral part of the telescope. So on the very first servicing mission, they brought up a series of optics that inserted themselves into the telescope that had exactly the opposite error built into them so that it canceled the error out and the telescope performed well. And since then, every camera that they send up to Hubble has optics in it that has the exact opposite error built in.
Yeah. And so what have we learned in the years since Hubble has been up there, besides just truly amazing photographs of deep space that are just mind-blowing, how beautiful it is?
Yeah, I think the best thing to say about Hubble is it's really revolutionized a number of different areas of astronomy. And I think it will go down in history as being one of the most productive scientific instruments ever built by human beings. It's been really a remarkable telescope. In part because when it was built, it was designed to be the Swiss Army knife of telescopes. It does everything. It has optical. It can look in the infrared portion of the spectrum. It can look in the ultraviolet. It has spectrographs to break light into its component colors. It does a lot of different things.
And so what's the latest on Hubble?
Well, the big news was that we were going to send up the fifth and final servicing mission, and it was scheduled for October 14th. But just a week ago or so, a little more than a week ago, there was a major failure on board the telescope, a series of electronics that gather up the data from the scientific instruments and format them to send them down to the ground failed. Now, it was a bad time to fail, but it could have been worse. It could have failed right after the servicing mission. At least it failed before the servicing mission. So NASA had to look hard at this because there's a backup channel. But once they switch over to that backup channel, with the primary channel dead, the backup doesn't have a backup anymore. And that's an absolutely critical part of the telescope. So it was decided to delay the servicing mission until they can refurbish a set of electronics that they can send up to replace the failed electronics.
Gosh, and so the money is there for that mission. It will happen.
Yes, the money is there. The crew is trained. They were ready to go on October 14th, except for this major electronics failure.
Yeah.
And the belief was that there was some debate about going ahead and launching and doing the servicing mission and just relying on that one side of electronics that they have left, but it really reduces the redundancy in the telescope and the safety. So it was decided that if we're going to try and keep Hubble alive for 5 to 10 years, they really needed to replace those electronics.
We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. Ed, where is the Hubble Space Telescope?
It's about
in relation to Charlottesville. I mean,
yeah, it's up.
Yeah,
it's 350 miles up, so it's not that far.
Where does it move in relation to one point on the Earth, or does it just?
Yeah, it's just orbiting around the Earth. So it orbits the Earth every 90 minutes, and it doesn't actually get as far north as Charlottesville does. It was launched out of Florida. So it only gets about as far north as 28 degrees north. It doesn't get much further north than that.
Amazing. So who decides, like, what it does? Like, who gets to say, okay, this is what we're going to do with Hubble next week?
There's an institute in Baltimore called the Space Telescope Science Institute that runs the telescope for NASA. And what they do is every year they solicit proposals from astronomers, or anyone for that matter. You send in your proposals, and they're reviewed with all the proposals sent in. And panels of scientists rank them from the best proposals to the worst. And the best proposals are given the observing time, and they move down until they run out of time on Hubble. And as it is right now, for every 7 proposals that are submitted, only one of them gets observing time on Hubble. That's how competitive it is.
Wow.
And an interesting thing to know is that anybody can apply for time. You don't have to be a professional astronomer. You just have to have a good idea. Now, of course, typically professional astronomers are awarded the time because we know the capabilities of the telescope and we know the projects that it can benefit from that, but anybody can apply.
What do you think's been one of the best uses of Hubble that you could look to and say, that was really cool?
One of the probably the least spectacular images to look at, but most spectacular images we've ever taken is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, where they spent 11 days staring at one little tiny piece of the sky. And it's the deepest image we've ever taken of the sky. We've never seen deeper or further into space than that one little image. And the most remarkable thing about it is that little tiny image, a tiny fraction of the size of the moon. There are about 10,000 galaxies in that little piece of the sky. Now, we'd love to survey the whole sky like that, but it would take 13 million pictures like that to cover the whole sky. And it took 11 days to get that one picture. So it would take over 130 million days to cover the whole sky like that. And Hubble's not going to last that long. I mean, 130 million days is hundreds of thousands of years. And so there's no hope of surveying the whole sky like that. But that one little image, if the rest of the universe is like that, it tells us there's about 130 billion galaxies in the universe. Each one has about 100 billion stars in it.
My gosh.
Yeah.
I can't even wrap my mind around that.
That's right. The whole point of it is...
And that's just what's observable from here.
That's right.
You know.
Although that does see pretty far into the universe. That sees pretty deep into the universe, but not as deep as the replacement for Hubble called the James Webb Space Telescope.
Which is due
in about 2013, depending on budget troubles and budget problems and technological issues with that telescope.
Yeah, well, that brings us to our next subject. How does this bad economy, they're saying the worst since the Great Depression, how does that affect folks like NASA or the institute that oversees Hubble? What can we expect?
I think, as with everything right now, it's unknown. We really have no idea what federal spending will be like in the next decade to come. I can tell you this, that inside of NASA right now, a lot of the money and a lot of the effort is going into the replacement for the space shuttle. The space shuttle is supposed to be retired in 2010. The replacement vehicle for that, the Orion spacecraft, is not going to be ready until about 2014. So first of all, there's a gap of 4 years where we have no way to get astronauts into space or up to the International Space Station. The plan had been to buy rides from the Russians, but with the recent conflict between Russia and Georgia, it's not clear that that's going to proceed. Although President Bush just signed the other day a law that allows this to continue, allows the United States to continue buying rides on these rockets from the Russians. But after that, the goal was to try and get back to the moon by about 2018. It was already clear that there's not enough money in the budget projections for NASA to both retire the shuttle and prepare to go to the moon again. NASA was either going to need more money or they're going to have to delay this project and put it off even further. And with the recent economic troubles and who knows what will happen to federal spending in the next few years, it can only get worse.
We're talking with UVA astronomer Ed Murphy. What's this I hear about the Chinese walking in space?
That's right.
That's a big deal for them, isn't
it? It is a big deal for them. So the Chinese have been pursuing a space program, a manned space program of their own. There are many countries that have launched satellites, but only three countries have ever launched human beings into space: the former Soviet Union, now Russia, the United States, and then finally the Chinese. A few years ago, the Chinese launched their first manned mission. And then a couple of years ago, they launched two men into orbit. This time, they've launched three men into orbit, and one of them actually stepped outside of the spacecraft and completed a spacewalk.
And should we be concerned at all about this? I mean, what does this mean?
I'm not sure what it means in the sense that the Chinese are just now doing what the United States and the Soviet Union did back in the 1960s. And to compare the capabilities, this mission to service the Hubble Space Telescope, we will have there will be five spacewalks, each spacewalk with two astronauts outside, each spacewalk lasting a total of 6 to 8 hours. And so on just that one mission, we're going to have a tremendous number of spacewalks to work on Hubble, which, by the way, will be the most complicated spacewalks that people have ever attempted in space. And the Chinese spacewalk was very much what we were doing in the 60s, where they go outside, they perform a few minor tasks, and they come back inside.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, they have to get there. Their ultimate goal is to develop a space station and to go to the moon. So they need to develop that ability, but they're taking first small steps right
now. And again, when is the Hubble thing rescheduled for?
Right now it looks like mid-February, but it could slip all the way to March.
And you're saying that is the most complicated spacewalk that would have yet been done?
The five of them, that's right. I mean, for example, in one case, there's an instrument on Hubble that's broken right now that they're going to replace. And the top of it is held down with dozens of tiny little screws that were never meant to be taken off by astronauts. And so if you imagine these people working in the vacuum of space and the giant gloves and the big bulky suits, and they're working around some of the most sophisticated instruments ever built and launched into space, they're going to have to work to get all those little screws out. They've got a special device that does this that will actually attach to the top of the box and unscrew all these screws and capture them all to make sure they don't float off inside the telescope. But it's really quite complicated, the tight little spaces they're working in and the very delicate instruments they're working
with. And how fast are they traveling?
Oh, well, they're 17,500 miles an hour while all of this is going on. But, you know, if they don't look up from their work, they don't really know. It's like being in an airliner when you're typing on your computer. You forget that you're going 600 miles an hour.
Amazing. Gosh. So, Ed Murphy, astronomer from the University of Virginia, what's the latest going on Mars? We've got, what, three vehicles there?
We've got the two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Both of them are still working, and both of them are still doing great. Opportunity has spent the last year in a giant crater called Victoria Crater, and just a couple weeks ago actually drove itself out of Victoria Crater to continue on now to another even larger crater off in the distance. It'll take it a few years to get to that larger crater. We don't know whether it will make it, but it'll be quite an adventure just to try and get there.
Yeah.
So... And there's also up on the North Pole of Mars, the Mars Polar Lander that we've talked about before.
And that's the one that found water, right?
Exactly. Found frozen ice on Mars. That mission's rapidly coming to a close because winter is setting in up there. The sun is going down. So they're not getting nearly as much power as they had before. So that mission only has a few weeks left.
Will that come back to life in the Mars spring?
It's programmed to try and bring itself back to life. Everyone's pessimistic that it will because right now it's getting down to about 120 below. In the middle of winter up there, it's going to get down to 180 to 200 degrees below zero. And the spacecraft was just never designed to survive those kinds of temperatures.
Amazing. We're talking with Ed Murphy, astronomer from the University of Virginia. Before we let you go, you are going to be host to a special event during the Virginia Film Festival in just a few weeks. That starts October 30th.
That's right. On Thursday, October 30th, at McCormick Observatory will be hosting a rebroadcast, a playing of the famous 1938 radio broadcast by the Mercury Theater on the Air, Orson Welles Theater, of the H.G. Wells book, War of the Worlds. And so we'll be hosting that at the observatory. People will be able to listen in to the full radio broadcast. We'll have Observing with the Telescope afterwards. And then later that evening at 10 o'clock, they'll be showing the 1953 War of the Worlds movie down at Culbreth Theater.
Awesome. So you can go up to the observatory the day before Halloween. Just a couple of weeks. And listen to War of the Worlds in the observatory.
In the observatory. You have to get tickets through the film festival. We're not selling the tickets. It's the film festival that's handling the tickets. But yes.
And what's the local, what's the connection of that building to the actual broadcast 70 years ago this year?
So after that broadcast, tens of thousands of Americans were scared that a Martian invasion was underway. So the very next night, about 75 students and townspeople from Charlottesville walked up the hill to look at Mars through the telescope to allay their fears that a Martian invasion was on the way. And so they were able to see Mars and see that it didn't look all that unusual and didn't look all that threatening.
That's great. Ed Murphy is an astronomer from the University of Virginia, and you can get more information online at astro.virginia.edu/pubnight. There you go. Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.